I see that neurosurgeon Sergio Canavero is back in the news again, claiming to have performed the first successful human head transplant. I actually interviewed Dr. Canavero on the coast a couple of years back. But before we get too far over our skis, this head transplant was performed on a human cadaver. So we're not quite there yet. Anyway, you can read a rather skeptical account of Dr. Canavero's work from the Guardian newspaper in the news section at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be back with James DiEugenio on the JFK Files right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serra coming to you live from Coast Toronto, Canada, affiliate Talk Radio AM 640. James DiEugenio, JFK assassination researcher, is with us, and he's been poring over the documents that were released, some October 26th, some November 3rd, some November 9th, and some just a couple days back. I did want to circle back to the Ruby and Oswald document. You mentioned this FBI report. Two witnesses in an electronics store saw them together, and that was several weeks before the assassination. But there was another one I was reading about recently, Jim. I don't know if you and I have talked about this, but somebody, a witness, supposedly saw Ruby and Oswald together. Again, this is a couple of weeks before the assassination. They saw Ruby and Oswald together at an airport in Key West, Florida. And apparently,
oh, wait a minute. I think I know what you're talking about.
There were a bunch of, they described them as hippie types.
That's in Gaten Fonzie's book, the late Gaten Fonzie, in the last investigation. Okay. And so, he actually went down there. All right. And he came away feeling that it wasn't all that credible. Okay. It's in his book, The Last Investigation.
Okay, but let me just summarize what the document says. That somebody saw Ruby and Oswald at this airport in Key West, Florida. They were surrounded by a bunch of hippie types that were supposedly going to Cuba to, quote, end quote, cut sugar cane. I don't know if that's code or not. But Oswald went up to Ruby, according to this witness, and said, again, they appeared to be talking in code, "Have you heard from Big Bird yet?" Now, what is Big Bird? I suppose if you know, we could connect the dots back to Lady Bird Johnson, the vice president's wife. So Lady Bird, Big Bird, Big Bird could be LBJ, hard to say. You don't think that's credible, though?
I Gaten Fonzie was one of the best field investigators of any JFK person that I've ever known, and so I trust his word. He actually went down there and talked to the guy. It's in the early part of his book.
All right. Okay, so that one may not pan out.
Can I say something, Richard? Because I really think that it's not enough for me to scream about this whole thing, about what's happening. How about the CIA and the FBI are breaking the law? You know, if I wouldn't be a very good advocate for this if I didn't tell your listeners, if you want to do something about this, and if you want to, do me a big favor, and this will only take a minute or two, go over to, there's a website, called the Trump White House. And what they can do at that website is you can shoot them an email or make them a phone call. I think there's two phone lines that they have. All right. So either one you prefer, put together an email or make a phone call. And just tell them, tell Mr. Trump, the president, that we would really like some actual, real openness and, declassification of these documents before it's too late. All right. So please keep your word on this and declassify everything. All right. And do it sooner rather than later, because they're just going to wait you out. They'll just wait you out. But that's what they've been doing for 54 years, is waiting us out. Okay. So if you take a minute or two and please do that for me, I would very much appreciate that. Okay.
That's so a good call to action for sure.
Of repaying all the work that I do to put on this show. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks, Richard.
All right. Yes, that's a great call to action, Jim. I think that's a terrific idea. Because this is in contravention of the law, right? What they're doing.
Yes, it is. They're literally breaking the law. You know, I don't know what kind of government we have anymore. You know, and when people can get away with breaking the law like this, and, you know, the president shoots out a tweet and that's the new law, you know, I don't understand that. You know?
All right, I want to.
It's outrageous, really.
We'll remind listeners, you know, what they can do again a bit later in the hour. But I want to ask you about this. This is one that has been reported because it is very strange. And this is the strange news tip received by a reporter at the Cambridge News in England just minutes before the assassination. Talk to me about that one.
All right. That's a very interesting story, okay, because the phone call he got, which was, I believe, 25 minutes before the assassination, told him to go over to the American embassy, all right, because there was going to be a very big story that was going to break out in about 25 minutes. And as far as I can tell, that story is true. That actually really did, happen. What makes it kind of interesting is that, to the best of my knowledge, the call came from a place called Grisby, England, which was the hometown of a guy named Albert Osborne. Albert Osborne was, the story gets so bizarre, he was reportedly by the FBI on a bus down to Mexico City with Oswald, whoever was impersonating him, in late September of 1963. All right? And he then came back to the United States afterwards, went back up to Canada, all right, and then went over to Europe. Now, I can't say that it was him making that phone call. I can't say it for sure, because nobody really knows if Osborne was at his hometown at the time of the call. It's a very indefinite. You know, he was supposedly somewhere in England at the time. All right, you know, but I can't really say that it was him because I don't know if he was there.
No, but even if it's not Osborne, Jim, the fact that an anonymous caller calls the Cambridge News and says there's going to be big news out of the U.S. Embassy in 25 minutes, and 25 minutes later the president is dead.
That's pretty darn interesting.
Beyond.
Yeah. Very, very, very interesting, you know.
I want to ask you about, because a number of documents dealt with how the Soviets were perceiving the assassination and whether or not they actually believed the official, you know, the Warren report and so forth. Let's talk about that. How did the Soviets react?
In my article, I have two documents on this particular point. Okay. One of them is an interview that Drew Pearson, who was a big-time Washington reporter at that time, did with Nikita Khrushchev, because they were both vacationing that summer, May of 1964, in Cairo.
Right. He was like Pearson, a bureau chief for Newsweek, wasn't he?
No, actually, he was the godparent, well, you know, figuratively, I don't mean literally, of Jack Anderson. He was kind of an independent, you know, guy, all right? In which right. Jack Anderson took over his column when Pearson passed away, all right? And so it was called the Washington Merry-Go-Round. It was syndicated through like 400 newspapers in the United States at that time.
But Pearson was a big believer. He was a big believer in the Warren Report, the official version, right?
And so he and his spouse and Nikita Khrushchev and his spouse met up in Cairo. Now, this, I think, was by accident, of course. And so they ended up talking about the Kennedy assassination. And Drew Pearson started spouting the whole official story at that time. And Khrushchev did not believe one single sentence that came out of his mouth, you know, but through this, because Pearson reported it to CIA station chief in Cairo afterwards. And he says, I argue with this guy up and down. I argue with his wife up and down. I couldn't make any headway at all. He really believes that there was a right-wing takeover of the United States. Okay, that the right wing killed Kennedy because he did not believe the security forces in the United States could be that terrible. All right? Now, by the way, it wasn't just Khrushchev, because we have another document that's also in this article, which tells us that the KGB was trying to get an emissary from India to talk to Bobby Kennedy, Earl Warren, and Lyndon Johnson, and tell them that there should be no stone left unturned in this investigation, because they really smell that something is rotten in Denmark about this Oswald story. So it looks like, in the whole upper level of the Russian government, nobody believed this. They all believed that Kennedy had been taken out by a high-level conspiracy.
What about de Gaulle in France?
Okay, well, we have that. That one's in David Talbot's book, The Devil's Chessboard. After de Gaulle got back after Kennedy's funeral, he had a sit-down meeting with one of his cabinet advisors, and this eventually was leaked to a reporter. And he came to the conclusion, well, the same thing that happened to Khrushchev, because I don't believe for 5 seconds that the security forces in the United States could be that horrible. Okay? I know what this is like because they tried to kill me. This had all the earmarks, you know, of a staged assassination. You know, you had this one patsy guy, you had these high buildings, you had a slow-moving car with a convertible top down. Okay. You know, so no, I don't believe that this Oswald story, you know, it's a bunch of paper mache. Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy.
Yeah. Was getting back to the Russians for a moment. Was Khrushchev concerned that who was ever responsible, they were going to try and pin it on the Soviets, and that it might lead to a war?
Yes. Oh yeah. But by the way, that actually happened before the assassination. Were you aware of that?
I was not.
Richard Case Nagel, okay, the man who knew too much, the guy who knew about the assassination before it happened.
Right.
He was called in to the KGB station in Mexico City, and he was told, we know from our informants that there's going to be a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy, and they're going to try and blame it on us. Okay? So we need somebody who knows the whole milieu, okay, to go ahead and try and snuff this thing out before it happens. All right? So, yeah, the Soviets did, you know, suspect, you know, that somebody was going to try and blame it on the Russians, you know. And of course, the whole thing with Kostikov at the Russian embassy in Mexico City is made to order for that, you know. If you believe, as I do, that it was just, you know, a charade, you know, then that's what it was made to order for.
Anything in this latest dump pertaining to the foiled assassination attempt in Chicago?
Oh, yeah, there actually is. There's a interview that the House Select Committee did with Abe Bolden, all right, which I think was in 1977 or 78. All right, now, I'm sure you probably had him on before, right?
I have not, no.
Oh, okay. Well, he's probably been on Coast to Coast and somebody else. Abraham Bolden is the guy who wrote a book called The Echo from Dealey Plaza, in which he talked about this attempt to kill Kennedy in Chicago, I think on November the 2nd, 1963, all right? And he says that this was snuffed out on a tip from the FBI to the Secret Service. And you know the kicker to this, don't you?
Well,
The code
yeah,
name of the tipster from the FBI was Lee.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So that tip came in to the Secret Service office in Chicago, and they managed to go ahead and thwart the plot to kill Kennedy, which the really important thing about that, which I've talked about in both my books, is that if you take a look at the design of the plot in Chicago, it's very similar to what actually really did happen in Dallas 3 weeks later. Okay, they had a high building. They had a motorcade, you know, coming off an expressway. They had a guy set up, and this guy, it was Arthur Vallee in Chicago, who had been a former military guy, all right, in this building. So in other words, if the Secret Service in Dallas, you know, would have had that information about what had happened previously, they very likely would have been able to thwart the plot that really did take Kennedy's life. But there was a big cover-up about that. And the guy in charge of it was also interviewed by the House Select Committee, and I read his very brief interview. And the two guys who went to see him said that the minute we turned to the attempted assassination of Kennedy in Chicago, the guy physically stiffened up. It was very clear he did not want to talk about it very much at all.
Ah, interesting. So do you think that Lee Oswald actually tried to foil, that he tried to save the president?
Well, you know, that's something I can't say for sure. But if you believe, as I believe, that part of Oswald's intelligence function was as an FBI informant, then yes, I think there's a good distinct possibility that that might be the case. I'm not saying it happened. I'm just saying that there's a distinct possibility that did happen that way.
Well, Oswald's supposed or alleged mistress, Judith Vary Baker, whether or not you believe that story or not, I don't know, but she insisted that Lee Oswald was a fan of JFK and was trying desperately to save his life, and somehow he got caught up and, again, was the patsy.
Well, there's no doubt he ended up being the patsy. You know, and I think there's a speech he made that he did say that he liked JFK. You know, I think that was in Mobile, Alabama, okay, a few weeks before the assassination.
We're heading into the bottom of the hour break here, Jim. When we come back, we'll open up the phone lines and take calls. People are lining up, as you can well imagine. But I just wanted really quickly to get your take. I think the last time we spoke, I sent you this, one of the documents. I sent you a PDF, and this was that the KKK had strong evidence that LBJ was one of theirs. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Did you have time to look at that document?
Yeah, I actually did read it. And I have to say, Ned, that's from, it's not really an FBI document. It's, the information is from the counselor, which was a north of New Orleans kind of right-wing segregationist journal. That doesn't mean that the information is wrong, because Ned Touchstone, the guy who published that journal, has some very good sources, and there's a couple things in that FBI bulletin that are actually correct. Okay.
All right, listen, Jim, let me jump in, and we'll pick up on that point when we come back. Sit tight. We'll come back, Jim DiEugenio, the JFK Files, and we'll get to your calls as well. Mavis Staples taking us into the break with Wrote a Song for Everyone, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back. Well, rather than wait for aliens to find us, a bold scientific project recently sent a message into space with the hopes that it will be heard by intelligent ETs. Researchers with the Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence Organization, or METI, announced they beamed the binary-coded missive via radio waves last month. The target for the message is a star known as GJ. 273, GJ273, who names these things, which is believed to be orbited by a planet which could harbor life and is only 12 light years from Earth. A mere 12 light years, a hop, skip, and a jump. And contained within the communique, astronomers at METI explained, or a rudimentary explanation of various mathematical concepts, insights into how humans measure time, and 33 songs. You can read more about this fascinating story in the news section where our webmaster tonight, Sean Latasore, has posted it up at the website coasttocoastam.com. I'm wondering whether among the rudimentary mathematical concepts was an explanation of trigonometry. If so, maybe they could beam that over to me because I'd like to know. Phone calls for Jim DiGenio when we come back right here on Coast to Coast AM. JFK assassination researcher Jim DiGenio is with us, and we will dive into the calls in just a moment. Let me just remind you, his website is kennedysandking.com, kennedysandking.com. Jim, before the break at the bottom of the hour, we were talking about the file on LBJ being a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and you had a couple more thoughts on that before I had interrupted you.
Yeah. That report is from The Counselor, which a magazine, a journal which I'm familiar with, because they were very interested in the JFK case. The last paragraph says that they have some solid evidence that LBJ years ago was actually a member of the Klan. They didn't say what it was in the report. I never seen that before, but I wouldn't dismiss it out of hand because, like I said, Ned Touchstone was not a hack, and he was not a liar. So that's something I'm going to have to look into. It might be accurate. I'm not sure.
It's interesting, yeah. But you know, when you look at the things that the mainstream media is focusing on with these JFK documents, and I threw that one in there. It's I would put that under the sort of the salacious category. I mean, it's important to know, but you know. The mainstream media is focusing on that document. They're focusing on some of the salacious stuff about that has come forward about Marilyn Monroe and her relationship with Bobby. They're focusing on the 2-cent bounty that the CIA had on Castro.
Right.
Those little curious and oddity, those odd little stories, but they're totally ignoring the important stuff, which is what you're focusing on, that Ruby knew Oswald before the assassination. You know, and the fact that, you know, the evidence that Oswald was not in Mexico City, they're totally ignoring that stuff, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're absolutely correct, and I'm so frustrated I could scream. You know.
All right.
It's really that bad.
Our on-air producer Donna Walker passed along a question from a listener, which she wants to know if you know about this. He was called the Quiet Don, Mafia kingpin Russell Bufalino, and a theory of his involvement in the Kennedy assassination. Apparently, Bufalino was involved in the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa in 75, but could he have been involved in the Kennedy assassination? Do you know anything about Bufalino?
I haven't read that book, so I really can't answer that question. You know, and I try and stay clear of speculating on things that I'm not really aware of. So I just can't answer that question.
All right, Wildcard Line, Mike is in Seattle, Washington. Mike, welcome to Coast AM.
Good afternoon, Mr. Surrett and Mr. DiGenio. I'd like to ask, first of all, I want to say hi to Natalie in a Women's Correctional Institute. And if I can ask now, with the parade route and the whole idea that this assassination was actually botched, you know, it's like, why wouldn't Oswald shoot, like, as soon as he had that straight-on shot, and rather than going through the trees and the whole convoluted, you know, triple trajectory, like, do you believe the assassination itself was botched and the kind of cover-up had to be recreated or kind of retrogressed from there?
All right. Let's talk about the parade route first. The motorcade, the presidential parade route being changed. I mean, that's been disputed.
That's true. That's turned out to be true. And there's a book on that by a guy named Vincent Palomera, who is the most foremost authority on the Secret Service, and he's come up with 3 or 4 sources that tell us that the motorcade route was changed the night before.
There you go. Now, okay. Who would have the power to do that?
And the Dallas police had to actually bring the other cops to what the new route was and trace it with them, or else they wouldn't have known. All right. So
Jim, the Mafia wouldn't have had the power.
I don't know
what
he's talking about when he says the assassination was botched, because in my opinion, it was a perfect operation. I mean, it went off so beautifully. It's kind of stunning.
Well, it's been described as a turkey shoot. I mean, they had gunmen everywhere. Yeah. It was a turkey shoot, Jim.
And they had the patsy right there on the scene. You know, so I think it turned out, if you're a bad guy, you know, if you're part of the hit team, you did a great job, you know. Okay.
All right. Carlos is in San Francisco on the Wild Card Line. Carlos, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi. Good afternoon. Good evening, gentlemen, and interesting conversation. And I know that the conversation is focused on the contents of these documents that have been released. So, you know, I don't want to delineate too much from that. I was going to ask about Judith Berry Baker, but since you brought that up, you know, I'm not go into any questions about that as far as the legitimacy of some of her claims. But there are a couple of documentaries, or a lot of documentaries on YouTube, and one of them is, they both came out in the late 80s and 90s, and I would love to have your guests comment on this. One is called, it was a multiple series called The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and another one was produced in 1993 by the BBC, and I don't remember the name of that. But the thing about the Men Who Killed Kennedy, there was a gentleman who claimed that in the documentary, who was supposedly with, or claims to, this person that was featured in this documentary, I guess he claims that he was with part of the intelligence community, but he happened to be attached to some office in the South Pacific, I believe in New Zealand, that had some, you know, the time change was so much that this person claimed that he was looking at the newspaper, which had the headlines that Kennedy had been assassinated when it hadn't happened yet.
That was Fletcher Prouty.
Okay. And I was just wondering, is there any copy or any way that we can get a hold of this newspaper or copy of it that actually, you know, confirms that? And then in the other documentary, and again, it was produced by the BBC in 1993, it claims that it even showed passages from Oswald's diary when he was a teenager about his fascination with Marxism or communism, and yet in another narrative is that, you know, he was kind of apolitical until whatever happened after the service or whatever cover was created for him to get into Russia, which, you know, I believe that's part of the cover as being an asset of the CIA. But I was just wondering, I mean, what does your guest think? What was Oswald into Marxism, into communism at a very young age? And then lastly, why wasn't Bobby Kennedy, why didn't he ever speak up as the attorney general with regards to where the autopsy was going to be performed, et cetera, et cetera? And so thank you for taking my call.
Okay, let's start with the Fletcher Prouty story, first of all. Great questions, Carlos.
That's not on The Men Who Killed Kennedy. That's in the movie JFK. And that's an accurate story, except he's not saying before it happened. He's saying the information got into that newspaper in incredibly fast time. And so when he picked up the newspaper in Christchurch, New Zealand, he was stunned that they could have that much information on Oswald. And the answer to that question might be a guy named Hal Hendricks, who, according to Seth Cantor, was a CIA asset, and he strongly believed that Hendricks was feeding that information into the either AP or UPI system within just a matter of minutes after the Kennedy assassination. Okay, now secondly, Oswald did not show any kind of allegiance to communism until he met, at least I've been able to do this, you know, try and pin this down, until he met a guy named David Ferry in New Orleans in the Civil Air Patrol. And then, of course, by the time the guy's in high school, he's actually writing letters to socialist youth organizations in New York while he's in Texas, okay? You know, so that seems to be the best explanation of how Oswald turned into this communist who wanted to join the Marine while he was in the Civil Air Patrol. As for the Robert Kennedy thing, there's a very good book on this subject called Brothers by David Talbot. And he makes a very good argument that although Bobby Kennedy did not make any waves in public about how bad the Warren Commission was, that in private, he had some very severe doubts about what had really happened to his brother. And as time went on, they got stronger and stronger. And a guy named Harold Weisberg got in contact with his entourage, and he heard about this, and he talked to one of his advisors and said, "You got to tell Bobby. If this is what he really thinks, he's got to come out in public, okay, and say it, or else the same thing that happened to his brother is going to happen to him." Well, a few weeks later, we all know what happened, and Weisberg then wrote, "Never was a prophet less happy with the prediction that he had made successfully."
Mm.
And I think so that true. Sums about that subject up.
So true. But I think Carlos was also alluding to, you know, the jurisdiction when the body was at Parkland Memorial Hospital, you know, then it was taken to Bethesda Naval Hospital, and, you know, who knows what happened
but
there.
But Bobby wasn't there.
No, but I guess the point is, could the family not have insisted? I mean, how would history have changed had the body remained at Parkland Memorial?
I think things would have been different, okay, because they had a very good forensic examiner there, a guy named Rose, all right, who was had a very good reputation. And I don't think, if they would have stayed in Dallas, they wouldn't have been he wouldn't have been intimidated, because, of course, we know what happened when the body got transferred to Bethesda. You had these three guys, two of them who had never done a gunshot autopsy before, and you had something like 40 guys there that night, many of them from the Pentagon, and one of them was supposed to be LeMay, you know, Curtis LeMay.
Right,
and there's no question that we know today that they interfered with that autopsy, and that's why we don't know today precisely how JFK was killed. I don't think that would have happened in Dallas.
Carrie's in Daytona Beach, Florida. Welcome, Carrie. Welcome to Coast.
Thank you so much.
You're on with Jim DiEugenio. Go ahead.
Yes, that last answer segued into my question is, what actually happened on the airplane I have read some reports and I don't know, YouTube things, that there was an actual brain transplant on the plane, and the doctors there were several doctors on the ground, different from that those who were in the air, and the ones in the air had to make this brain transplant as to make it look like something else. So I'm trying to understand what happened during this brain transplant.
Okay, I've never heard that story, and they could not have done that on the plane. But,
well, no, my understanding was security was lax on the plane. They were lax.
No, there was always somebody near the actual casket. Okay.
I guess the question is, what happened to Kennedy's brain in the end, though, Jim?
Yeah.
What
okay. Now that's a good question. That's a very good question. All right, if we adjust it for a little time frame later, because one of the big mysteries about the Kennedy autopsy is that the brain was not weighed that night, which is a big bad no-no. If you have a gunshot wound to the skull, all right, there's no what they call fresh brain weight. All right, for some reason that was not done. And on top of that, you have, and I go over this at length in my book, Reclaiming Parkland, okay, you had something like 14 witnesses who said that a large part of the brain was gone. And this includes Dr. Humes, who was the chief forensic pathologist that night. Well, see, the problem with that is this, that the later weighing of the brain the brain comes in at 1,500 grams, which is actually above average for a guy of Kennedy's height and weight. How could his brain be above the norm if everybody said a large part of it was gone? It just makes no sense. And on top of that, let me give you the capper, because there's always a capper with the Kennedy assassination. Years later, when the review board interviewed the official photographer of the Kennedy autopsy, a guy named Stringer, they brought him to the National Archives, showed him the pictures of the brain in the National Archives, which depict an almost intact brain. And the chief counsel, Jeremy Gunn, asked Stringer, did you take those pictures? And Stringer looked, and you couldn't have rehearsed it any better if you were doing a movie. He looked at the pictures very closely, kind of hesitated, and then said, no, I didn't take those. And he goes, how do you know you didn't take them? Because you see that name of that film? That's ANSCO. I never used that film when I was doing autopsy pictures. And you see the way you can see the numbers in the lower corner? That means it was taken by a process photography thing. I never used that technique. It's a press pack. So no, I can tell you right now with certainty that I never took those pictures. So here the question then becomes, of course, Richard,
yes,
who the hell did take the pictures?
Exactly.
And maybe even more important, why? Why was it necessary? And I'll tell you why I think why. Because I think the original brain would have showed too much brain damage from more than one bullet.
Precisely.
Okay?
Precisely. Jim, give us our marching orders again. What do you want us to do?
Okay. There is a Trump White House website, okay? And I would really appreciate it if the people listening tonight, and you have a very big audience from what I understand, okay, would go over there, okay, and it gives you the information of how to go ahead and either call the White House or email the White House, all right? And I would really appreciate if you would go over there and press either email or take down the phone number and tell President Trump that these people are breaking the law and you're the only person in the executive branch that can stop them from breaking the law. We really want to see you live up to your promise to go ahead and declassify everything in its complete form. 54 years are enough of secrecy. So if you can do that for me, I'd very much appreciate that.
It's the least we can do, Jim, after all you've done for us here on Coast to Coast AM. Thank you so much for this. The website again.
My pleasure.
Kennedysandking.com. Kennedysandking.com. Thanks again, Jim.
Have a good one.
All right. When we come back, Thomas Colbert, citizen sleuth, leading a cold case team that has apparently cracked the D.B. Cooper case. The only problem, the FBI doesn't seem to care. We'll find out more on the other side here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us.